And behold, two of them were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking with each other about all these things which had taken place. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself approached and began traveling with them, but their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are these words that you are exchanging with one another as you are walking?" And they stood still, looking sad. One of them, named Cleopas, answered and said to him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things which have happened here in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "The things about Jesus the Nazarene, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word in the sight of God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to the sentence of death and crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. Indeed, besides all this, it is the third day since these things happened. But also some women among us amazed us when they were at the tomb early in the morning and did not find his body. They came saying that they had also seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just exactly as the women also had said, but him they did not see. And he said to them, 'O foolish men and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken, was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and to enter into his glory?' Then beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures."
Open there to the reading. You might want to leave them open. If you haven't turned there yet, you might want to take your Bibles and open that up. We're going to be going back to that reading or that passage here in just a few minutes. I want to pause, though, to state a couple of things. First of all, in making the announcements, I noted that Ron and Polly were not here. I've also noticed that Tom and Kelly Russell are not here as well. So we may want to check up on them, make sure everything is okay. Maybe they're snowed in up there at their home. The other thing is, it's usually typical for the preacher, as he begins the sermon, to welcome the visitors. But in this case, this morning, it'd be rather redundant since I gave the announcements. But nevertheless, we want to emphasize the fact that for anyone that is visiting with us, we're glad that you're here. And we truly want to ask you to stick around so we can get to know you better, be able to visit with you after the services. The reading that was given here this morning, I consider would be one of the most fascinating incidents recorded in all of the Bible. Here you had the stuff of which movies are made. Two men walking and talking to Jesus, and they didn't even know who it was they were talking to. And then suddenly, after the reading ended here this morning, they suddenly realized just exactly who it was that they'd been talking to. And so they ran back after they had walked with Jesus here, and after they had traveled with him for this time. And this is from an earlier sermon here, and you can see here's Emmaus here, and here's Jerusalem, and it's about 7 miles, and that's as far as they were planning to go. And they got over to Emmaus, and I apologize if I'm pronouncing the name of the town incorrectly. I've heard it pronounced otherwise. I just don't know how these two men would have pronounced that word. But they got close to the town there, and Jesus then began to as it says there in verse 27, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. And then they went in and it got a little closer, and they began to sit down to eat, and all of a sudden Jesus did something that reminded them of the master, and they realized who it was then, and they immediately ran back to Jerusalem excited, and they went and told the disciples. And we go down to verse 36. They were as they had Well, if we don't even go that far, they told what had happened on the road and how he is known to them in the breaking of the bread. Then later on, as they were talking about these things, Jesus came and he stood with them. And he said, "Peace to you," but they were startled and frightened and thought they saw a spirit. And this again, there are so many lessons in this chapter right here. This is one of them. This is an evidence for the resurrection. That indeed the disciples could not have possibly stolen the body as the Jews wanted to claim. Because here we have an account that when Jesus did appear, they were afraid. What is this? So then he asked them, "Why are you troubled?" there in verse 38. "And why do doubts arise in your heart?" And he points out his hands and his feet. Then it says in verse 40 that he showed them his hands and his feet. In verse 41, they still disbelieved for joy. Even after this evidence, they still disbelieved. "Is it really you, Master? Is it really you?" And they were marveling and said to them, have you, and he said to them, "Have you anything to eat?" So they gave him a piece of boiled fish, and he took it and ate for them. But I want to focus on the next verse, because that's what we're going to be looking at this morning. He said to them, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled." And we're going to look at a question here. Just so, what are some of these things that Jesus that was referring to that were in the prophets and they were in the law of Moses and were in the Psalms even that pointed to him? And so the first thing that we look at is the concept of resurrection in the Old Testament. There are some people today that just simply refuse to believe that the Bible has any merit whatsoever. And I know that's no surprise to any of you here this morning, but in coming up with their arguments, they will come up with some of the craziest ideas, even if they don't make any sense at all. And one of the things that they have come to try and sell among themselves is this idea that the concept of the resurrection, Jesus being resurrected, why, that was just something that the Christians of the first century invented. That the concept of the resurrection, it didn't exist in the Old Testament. And what they're trying to do is to say that, well, okay, look, Jesus' body disappeared. We don't know what happened to it. Maybe one of his disciples did have enough chutzpah to be able to go in there and steal it. But here with the Messiah's body has disappeared. We'll invent this concept that he was resurrected. And we'll sell that to the people. Now, there are so many problems with that. It doesn't begin to be to really give it any kind of consideration. First of all, men and women went to their deaths affirming the validity of the resurrection. Men stood up and said, "I saw the Lord before he died. I saw him after he died." You don't go to your death for a lie. And yet, time after time after time, men did. But furthermore, the idea that the Christians had invented this idea of resurrection in order to sell the Messiah idea to the masses is pure lunacy, because there is so much evidence within the Old Testament to indicate otherwise. Now, one of the things that we wanted to talk about here and point out is we're talking about two different concepts. If anyone does want to bring this up, There are two different concepts we're talking about. One is resuscitation. We have several examples. We have more than one example in the Old Testament of individuals that are what you could put in quotes, resuscitated. And what we mean by that is they were dead. They were raised from the dead, but they eventually died again. If you're resurrected, the definition there is you're raised with a different body and that you would not die again. That is the concept of a resurrection. But the idea in order to have a resurrection, man has to have a spirit that lives on after he's died. That if you don't believe that man has a spirit that lives on after he dies, then the idea of a resurrection doesn't make any sense at all. If you're like Rover, you're dead all over once you're dead, then yes, it's silliness to talk about a resurrection. So the first thing we can point out with these examples of resuscitation, if you want to call them that, in the Old Testament, is that it at least demonstrates that the Jews had a concept that when you die, you did have a soul that lived on. You have the example there of the son of the widow of Zarephath in 1 Kings 17, verses 17 through 24. Prior to this, Elijah was called by God to be a prophet, and he went to Ahab and he said, hey, it's not going to rain now for 3 years. Or it's not going to rain until I say it's going to rain. And it turned out to be 3 years. And this was exactly what God had promised the Israelites before they even crossed the Jordan River. That he told them, if you don't do what I say, there are bad things that are going to happen to you, one of which was to withhold the rain. And so God says, that's it. I've had enough. It's not going to rain. Finally, God decides that, okay, time's up. And while this is happening then, Elijah goes into hiding. And the reason he goes into hiding is he's been the one that's come to Ahab and said it's not going to rain. So first he goes to a brook and the ravens feed him, but the brook dries up because guess what? It's not raining. So then God sends him to this widow of Zarephath where she has this jar of oil and a jar of flour that never run out. And so after a time, the young man dies. And then there in verses 17 through 24, we have the account of Elijah raising this man from the dead. Another example we have is Elijah's successor, who is Elisha, who would go have a circuit that he would travel. And it was a Shunammite widow. She lived in Shunem. And she realized that he was a man of God. She built a place for him to stay at her house and invited him to stay there when he traveled through, which he did. And so for her generosity, he said, what do you want? And she said, he said, you want me to get you an audience with the king or something else like that? And Elisha's assistant says, well, wait a minute, she doesn't have a son. She's barren. And so Elisha said, this time next year, you'll be holding a son. Well, the son is born, and so sometime later then, I think several years later, he complains of his problems with his head, and he dies. And so she goes to Elisha, and so Elisha then goes to him, and he resurrects her son. So we have that as two instances right there. The other thing is we have what I consider another instance of what I would call an indication of humor or sense of humor on God's part. And we run across these from time to time. In 2 Kings chapter 13, verses 20 through 21, you had an instance where they were going to bury a man who had died. Elisha had already died, and it just so happened that he was buried in the same place where this man was going to be buried. And the Moabites came with a raid, and someone came running up saying, "Hey, the Moabites are coming." So they just threw his body into the grave, and he happened to touch the bones of Elisha, and he jumped up and revived, and he was resurrected or resuscitated, as a result of that. And so there's three instances right there where we have demonstration of life after death. We have another one, if those that are in the auditorium class here on Sunday morning, of an instance that we studied recently that also demonstrates a Jewish concept of life after death, and that was the idea of the witch of Endor, or the medium of Endor, that conjured up the spirit of Samuel for King Saul. Now, somebody would say, well, maybe it was an illusion. It really doesn't matter for purposes of the lesson here. It really doesn't matter. If there was no concept of life after death, why would Saul even think of trying to go find anyone to bring him in contact with Samuel? Samuel was dead. He was gone. There was no way anybody could ever contact him. But it was only because the Jews did understand that there was life after death, and therefore there must be a resurrection at some point in time, that he even decided that he was going to try and have any kind of conversation at all with Samuel to find out what was going to happen in the battle the next day. And the idea is that, or the other thing too to point out is that this wasn't just a Christian concept, this idea of a resurrection or life after death. What there was a fellow that wrote a commentary on the book of Isaiah, and he had written that the Egyptians, and some of you may recall this from your history classes, Egyptians had an intricate theology of life after death centuries before Isaiah. Even the Canaanite religion depended on the annual triumph of Baal over death. And so we're forced to conclude that an all-knowing and caring God would provide for punishment of wicked deeds in this life, and the concept of life is found in also other words, this is the fellow who concluded that in the name of all logic, how could Israel, with its foundational belief in the living God, lack within revealed religion what others arrived at by wishful thinking and natural religion? It just doesn't make any sense that to be able to contend that this idea of resurrection existed only in the minds of those in the first century that wanted to start this religion or this sect called Christianity. Well, besides those instances, we have examples within the scriptures that have other indications of where individuals have said things that teach us clearly that they had a concept of life after death. We have the indication of Abraham, who was told to go offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice. And his last statement to those that went with him, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." Well, but he's going to go kill his son. Why kill his son if he's... Because, and this, by the way, is the son through whom all nations are going to be blessed. Or that he's got, that through whom Abraham will be the father of a multitude of nations. Well, Hebrews answers us that question. In verse 19 there, it says, "He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back." So what Hebrews tells us is Abraham already had a concept that there was life after death, that God could raise someone from the dead. We skip ahead to Moses. We have the incident of the burning bush. And there at the burning bush, God tells Moses there, he said, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And as Jesus points out, emphasizes there in Matthew 22, Mark 12, and also in Luke chapter 20, the verb there, I am, is present tense. So that God is saying that these individuals are not dead, there's something living still about them. And that would be their spirit. Hannah, this is somebody's idea of Hannah when she was praying to God there at the temple, and Eli is there, and he thinks she's drunk. And she's praying to God for a son, which God grants to her. And when she comes back, she sings a song. We have recorded to it for us in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Verse 6 of that, she says, the Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. There's plain as day that even as early as 1 Samuel, in the days immediately after the waning days of the judges, you had Israelites who firmly believed in life after death, which would imply an eventual resurrection. You have King David. This is somebody's idea of what perhaps it would have looked like there as the child that was conceived by Bathsheba in their adulterous relationship was going to die. And David is praying and mourning over this. And eventually the child, as promised, dies. And David's response was, after he'd found out the child was dead, he says, but now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. And what David is saying there, he's still alive. There's a spirit of him that still remains, and it's possible for me to eventually go to him, but he cannot cross back over into this life. And that's recorded for us there in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 23. We have others that we can point to. Job, who makes the statement in chapter 19, verses 25 to 27. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, after I'm dead, is what Job is saying, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me. We have Isaiah promising and talking about what's going to be coming, the future how God is going to take care of the Israelites in the long term. In Isaiah chapter 25, in the first part of verse 8, he will swallow up death forever, and the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. In the previous verse, he had said he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. That veil, or that covering that Isaiah is talking about here, is death, which he explicitly states there in verse 8. So God's going to swallow up death in verses 19 through 21 of the next chapter. He says, your dead shall live, the body shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy. For your dew is a dew of light, and the earth will give birth to the dead. Come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourselves for a little while until the fury has passed by. For behold, the Lord is coming out from his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for iniquity, and the earth will disclose the blood shed on it and will no more cover its slain. And what this passage is promising, not only that there's going to be a resurrection, but there's going to be a resurrection with a judgment. There's going to be a purpose for this resurrection that's going to happen. Daniel chapter 12, the first two verses there. At that time shall rise Michael, the great prince, who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Another example of where the Jewish thought included the concept of not just a resurrection, but a resurrection with a judgment. And we could point to Ezekiel chapter 37, which is talking about the valley of the bones. And while some may want to say, well, that's talking about a resurrection of a large number of people, it's still going to be composed of individual resurrection. Then there's the Psalms. Psalm 16, we have a statement there that's quoted by the Apostle Peter on the day of Pentecost, where he said there, "You'll not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption." And what Peter had said in Acts chapter 2 and verse 25 is that David knew that this was a prophetical statement. David was making this statement saying that there's going to be, that this Messiah is not going to see corruption. That is, he's going to be resurrected. So this is a messianic or a prophecy of the fact that Jesus was going to be raised from the dead because it would be on the third day, because the Jews believed that after 3 days the body would begin to decay. We have Psalm 22 is another example. This is a psalm that necessarily infers the death of the speaker there in verse 15. And then later on, beginning in verse 22, it begins to talk about how the speaker is going to be must be resurrected, because the speaker goes on and on about all of the praises that he's going to sing to God. And so we have evidence there from Psalm 22 that the writer is suggesting that there's going to be a resurrection of the speaker who we know was the Messiah. Other prophecies we can point to. First of all, we can look at Hosea, who is quoted by the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 4. "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on a third day in accordance with the Scriptures." Which Scriptures? Well, we see that in Hosea chapter 6 and two verses there. "Come, let us return, Lord, for he has torn us, that he may heal us. He has struck us down, and he will bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up, that we may live before him." Now, we read this, we can see that can apply either to the nation of Israel in general, or to the Messiah. But when you begin to apply it to the nation of Israel, you run into problems. How is it after 2 days the entire nation is going to be revived? It makes far more sense to see this as a messianic prophecy, and that's exactly what the Apostle Paul was referring to there in 1 Corinthians 15. Isaiah, again, in a passage that all of us are very, very familiar with, Isaiah chapter 53. In verse 9, it says, "They made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, there was no deceit in his mouth. And then in verse 10, the very next verse, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. First of all, you can't make an offering for guilt if you're dead. And secondly, to prolong his days means he's going to live forever. And that's what Isaiah is writing about here in with respect to the Messiah. Saying that he will be raised from the dead because he will be living forever. So what do we walk away from this with? Well, sometimes the truth is hard to find. We have some that God did not make truth, lay it out there for us to just go ahead and turn to it and catalog it. Sometimes there's some seeking involved, some effort involved to be able to identify truth. This is why Proverbs tells us to buy the truth and sell it not. But it requires diligence to uncover it. It may take some serious Bible study, may take some meditation, thinking about what the scriptures are really saying. And there's a sermon I've got coming down the road here that where we're going to be looking at some examples of individuals that wrestled with problems in the scriptures and how they stumbled as a result. But we need to recognize that God made truth something that we all need to work at in order to find, in order for us to demonstrate just how much we really do have a love for the truth. One of the things that people want to tell us is that the suffering and death of Jesus was because plan A didn't work. That Jesus came and he was going to set up this earthly kingdom and, he got rejected. And the death on the cross wasn't really all that planned. It was a plan that went askew. And what we see in the scriptures is, no, everything that happened was exactly the way God planned it. Everything, every prophecy of the Messiah was fulfilled. Every single one. And so it was not a mistake on the part of Jesus that he came too early and the Jews just didn't accept him and they wound up rejecting him and crucifying him. That's such a blasphemous concept. I'm surprised that any that claim to be Christians will seriously hold it. The idea that God had made any kind of a mistake at all. There was no plan B when Jesus came to this earth. There was no backup plan. There were no backup measures. God was in absolute control. Everything happened exactly the way God foretold it and the way God had planned it. Finally, the justice of God. The justice of God demands that there be a resurrection and a judgment. If we learn anything at all about God, even in the Old Testament, we learn that he's a God not only of love, as defined for us there in Exodus chapter 34, but rather we learn that he's also a God of justice, where he visits the penalties on those that reject him. And so the idea that, if I die, that's the end of me. That's all there is. I just go to sleep or everything goes blank and I have no consciousness, no existence at all. And it's all over. And then anything that I had done in my life, everything that I had done with any kind of consequence at all, why, if I got away with it, then that's it. I got away with it. There's no justice in that at all. So any God that has a love for those that are righteous, that do decide that they're going to live their life on even a higher moral standard, however you want to define that, there must be a penalty for those that choose not to live their lives on any kind of a moral standard. Live amoral lives. Live lives without any kind of law or no respect for God or for man. And so as we read through the scriptures, we not only begin to see that this justice of God demands this resurrection, we actually begin to desire it. Not as vengeance, not as to see anyone penalized, but just to understand that even when I do something wrong, there's a penalty to be paid. That's the only right way to deal with anyone's actions. It may be that you're here this morning and that you have come to realize just how hollow this idea of there being no God really is. That it leaves you with a concept of there's no purpose to your life. It leaves you with a concept that there's nothing to be gained in life if there's no God. I'm just here to satisfy whatever desires I might have. And anything I can get from you or I can get from anyone else, that's okay. Just get it while you can. And that's so hollow. And it may be you're an individual that really has begun to think about that and decided that you really need to give yourself to God. And you need to admit the fact that you do have sins. And you need to admit the fact that yes, that you need to avail yourself of the remedy that God has provided, which is the blood of His Son, Jesus Christ. We want to encourage, we'll sing a song here in a minute. It's designed to encourage you to make that decision to yield yourself to God and to give your life to Him. The song is designed to try and ask you to consider the situation in which you find yourself, and we're going to be begging with you, pleading with you, that if you need to put on your Lord in baptism this morning, be able to have your sins washed away, we stand ready to help you, encourage you to do that. If you're an individual that perhaps has done that, but yet you've fallen away, you need the prayers, you need the assistance of the congregation here. We also want to encourage you to let us know if either of those apply to you. Let us know by coming to the front as we stand and we sing this song that's been selected.